This is Tyson Brown with NSTA Press. This marks our eighth installment of NSTA Press Behind the Books. Today I'm talking with Dick Konacek, the author of Everyday Science Mysteries, Stories for Inquiry-Based Science Teaching, a book that uses mystery stories to engage students' attention right from the start. The narratives present a scientific conundrum in the form of an open-ended story, the mystery, and students have to engage in actual investigations to solve that mystery and finish the story. Dick, welcome.
Thanks, Tyson. I'm glad to be here.
Dick, the mysteries help present science in the context of the real world, which to me seems so practical and intuitive. Why are so many teachers challenged by this approach? Is it time or lack of content knowledge?
Well, actually, the real world science is or can be counterintuitive in a lot of cases. Science answers to a lot of questions are not what you might expect. For example, it's about 9 o'clock in the morning, and I was out looking at the moon in the daytime, a three-quarter moon in the southwest sky, and it was beautiful.
Oh, I missed that.
And I thought to myself, you know, a lot of people think that the moon is a strictly nighttime phenomenon, and it's up in the daytime sky about half the time. So even though mysteries seem to be intuitive, they're not. I try to point out a lot of everyday things that people fail to see but are very interesting. So perhaps because they are so common, people just fail to notice them.
Dick, you provide more than just the mystery story. How do you prepare the teacher to use the mysteries?
Well, I try to put in the book sections on the purpose of the story, the related concepts that might arise. I like to give them a heads up on possible misconceptions that students might have, like things that they might not expect that they're ready when the students come up with them. The content background, links to the standards and benchmarks, and using the stories with both K-4 and 5-8, then I finish with references.
You mentioned misconceptions. What are some of the best ways you think a teacher can tackle student misconceptions and preconceptions?
Yeah, research tells us that we have to confront the student's misconceptions in order to see that they're not workable. I like to use a chart called Our Best Thinking Till Now, which lists what children already think they know about the concept. Then I like to change the statements to investigable questions, which the children check out. For example, in Where Are the Acorns, the story really focuses on seasonal and daily solar shadows, daytime astronomy, if you will. Children say that the sun is directly overhead at noon. We change that to, is the sun directly overhead at noon? This is a question that can be investigated and shown to be untrue, unless, of course, you live in the tropics.
Right.
We could then deal with those data and modify the conception. Actually, I think the most important quote that I do in the book is from Eleanor Duckworth, who says, the critical experiments themselves cannot impose their own meaning. One has to have done the major part of the work already. One has to have developed a network of ideas in which to embed the experiments. This is why I try to have the students own the problems and develop that network of ideas and then to investigate their own questions to fit into that network of ideas, their ideas.
What are some of the techniques a teacher can use to create the kind of supportive, open environment where students feel free to share their conceptions about a science topic?
Well, I think that anyone who works with kids has to create an atmosphere of trust. This means listening, particularly, and responding to a student and avoiding an inquisition type of atmosphere. If kids truly believe that the teacher is responding and listening to them and not judging what they are saying, they're more likely to respond honestly. Paige Keeley's probes do a lot of that sort of thing in written form, and when teachers show kids that they really want to know what they think, kids can detect the sincerity and respond accordingly. I've always said that kids are more likely to solve teachers than problems, so it's up to the teacher to make themselves into the kind of teacher that is worth solving.
Depending on how sophisticated a teacher wants to get, these stories really work in almost any science class and grade level. Can you offer some tips about how the stories might be modified to work with different grade levels?
Well, sure. In the Acorn story, I offer a vignette about how a second grade science teacher and a sixth grade teacher both use the same story, but at different levels of sophistication. The primary teacher, for example, focused on how the shadows change over a season, and the sixth grade teacher tackled her kids' interest in involving seasons and shadows and changes over seasons throughout the day and in various seasons. If the children's interests lead the teacher, she can take the story from whatever is relevant and developmentally appropriate for her students.
You encourage teachers to have their students work like real scientists, to collaborate, keep their own data, write their reports anecdotally. Does this come naturally to most students?
Absolutely not. It doesn't even come naturally to adults. I worked as a researcher in the Everglades National Park as a volunteer each winter, and I had to learn all over again how to keep a good notebook. I learned that I should never trust my memory, but I should write everything down. I had a great mentor in the wildlife biology I work with. Michael Clenchey, in his book, Using Science Notebooks in Elementary Classrooms, had some wonderful ideas on how to help students become good communicators of their data and their findings.
Have you faced any unexpected challenges when presenting a mystery?
A lot of mysteries started out as mysteries to me. Some I remember from my childhood, and some I find every day as I go through my day. I find that I am full of misconceptions, too. And then when I try to explain to myself the explanations for what I investigate myself, it seems as though I am wrong about what I believe to be true.
You mention in one of the introductory chapters the role that talking plays in developing effective scientific science literacy skills. Can you elaborate on how talking about science discoveries plays a part in overall science literacy?
Yeah, I remember very, very vividly. I once had a student who, while talking out loud about a problem, said, "Now that I hear myself say that, I realize I'm contradicting myself." That's a metacognitive process. The other side of the coin is that communication means putting your understanding into words that make sense to you and to those who are listening to you. Talking assumes listening, and both skills are grossly underestimated in learning. As I quote Neil Postman in the book, biology is not plants and animals. It's a language about plants and animals. I believe that the main part of conceptual change in children and adults comes while they're involved in a discourse with other people, talking, listening, arguing, and measuring the ideas against others. Hands-on is nothing without the minds-on part. Activity is often useless without discussing it with others afterwards.
Dick, why do you think there is a need for this sort of book? Did you have a specific audience in mind?
Yeah, I believe that there is so much science in our world that goes unnoticed that we need people to see it rather than walk right past it. I believe that teachers, parents, and those who are engaged in homeschooling can find the book useful. I also believe that anyone who is interested in the world around them can find the investigated fascinating and illuminating. Most of my stories come out of real-life situations. They're not invented. They have a base in what is called living and seeing.
What instructional goals did you have as you put the book together?
Well, I wanted adults to see that children have ideas about everyday happenings and that these ideas relate to the national standards and have a place in formal or informal education. My science teacher, when I was in elementary school, was a Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. I spent most weekends there pushing buttons and trying to figure things out. I know that kids have interests in the world around them, and I wanted them to push some buttons too. Schools don't usually have time for button pushing because they're so trying so hard to cover the whole curriculum in one school year. In short, I think I wanted teachers to let kids have the freedom to get involved in the mysteries that make up science.
Are there ways teachers should not use this book?
Well, I would hope that teachers would not look at the content background section and just use this to lecture their kids about the answers to the mystery. That section is really there to help them feel a little more comfortable with the background and to be able to lead the kids when they need some help.
as you include a great deal of detail. Does this pose a challenge or an opportunity?
Well, the challenge to me was that even after 50 years of studying science, I didn't know as much science as I thought I did. But I found resources that helped me to bone up and try to explain things in as simple and world-oriented way as possible. I knew words, I knew formulas, but when you're trying to explain something to someone, you have to know what you're talking about, and I mean know. I have learned so much during the writing of this book and the next one that I cannot express how many gaps there were in my knowledge base.
A big part of the investigations is communication. Do you see any value in students using various web tools like blogging, wikis, recording podcasts as an alternative to writing conclusions to the stories?
Well, Tyson, I believe that any form of communication that helps kids to interact with others has to be helpful. However, I do believe that somewhere along the line, they need to put their conclusions in a form that makes sense to them as well as others. Some kids draw their conclusions better than they can write them. All that I would demand is that kids communicate their findings in some way that helps them and others to a deeper understanding.
I understand you're working on Volume 2, More Everyday Science Mysteries. Can you give us a preview?
Sure. There are going to be more Earth and space, biology, and physical science stories, 5 of each. I revisit the trees from helicopters because of what I learned by observing the maple outside our kitchen window and answering my own questions, which never occurred to me over my entire lifetime, which is considerably lengthy. I also look at color in a way to attack the misconceptions surrounding light and how we see. And the rest, you'll just have to wait until you see the book.
How did you revisit trees from helicopters? What do you mean by that?
Well, in the first volume, there was a story about two kids who were watching the little helicopter seeds from the maples on the ground, and they had to sweep them up. Uh-huh. And they never realized before that trees actually have flowers and produce seeds.
Sure.
And so I went back to it this time because in the meantime, I noticed something very, very different about maple trees, and that is the fact that they have separate male and female flowers.
Ah.
And so I wanted the kids to work on that.
So each individual tree has a male and female flower, or are there female trees and male trees?
It can be either way, and I didn't know that either.
Interesting. Dick, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to me today. For more information about everyday science mysteries, stories from inquiry-based science teaching, including a sample chapter called The Magic Balloon, which explores the relationship between temperature and pressure of gases through balloons and objects that will float in the air, go to www.nsta.org and click on the Science Store. This is Tyson Brown signing off from NSTA Press.